introduced what the Lie derivative might be about by talking about the Lie bracket or commutator of two vectors. So we saw that at least in the case of vectors, we could construct something that could be interpreted as a derivative, although it wasn't quite so obvious whether it was S being the derivative along T or vice versa. So what we'll do now is we'll discuss this type of derivative more generally to show how it acts on some general tensor, and then, you know, sort of identify, therefore, what the interpretation of the Lie bracket was. So I want to start by kind of always with geometry, I like to always kind of build up some sort of intuition or try and figure out, you know, why are we defining something to be the way it is, rather than just sort of taking the definition as, you know, on trust. It's nice to stop and think, well, if I wanted to define this, how would I do this? So here I'm going to say, sort of start thinking about, well, suppose we want to take a derivative of some geometrical object, how might we do it? So schematically, when we take a derivative, what we're doing is we're saying, well, we look at some close by point and we compare our object at this close by, not point, some close by value of our parameter that we're taking the derivative with respect to, in this case t, and we take the difference between our quantity, these two values of our parameter, and then divide by delta t. And we hope that the limit as delta t goes to zero is well defined. So that's our just abstract or schematic definition of a derivative. And so if we are going to apply this to sort of actual tensorial objects on a manifold, then we sort of have to see, do a different color. So this is our thought process, if you like. So I've already mentioned this, but it's worth just, you know, sort of pulling it out again so that we can figure a way around this problem. So on a manifold, if we go to two different points on the manifold, we're in two different tangent spaces. So that means our tensor is not a member of the same space, so it's being a bit cheeky to just take a subtraction. So that's one comment. And then also we have to sort of figure out what do we mean by this. And of course, therefore, what is this? So those are our obstructions. These are the problems that we have to figure out how to solve. And so to do this, I want to return to diffeomorphisms. So you know you've already seen the connection. We know that we can do it via a connection, but the Lie bracket is not a connection. So I talked last time about maps between manifolds, the push forward and the pullback. And so I want to return to this concept. So we're going to use maps, a map on the manifold to take us from T to T plus delta T. So that's the idea. So the diffeomorphisms of a manifold form a group, because if we map from one point to the other, we can always one-to-one and onto, so we can always map back, we have inverses, and of course if we do two coordinate transformations, we've got a third one. So it's obviously a group. So we can ask, what are the generators of the group? So typically when we have a group, then our group is generated by elements of an algebra that we then kind of exponentiate and sort of act with. So if we think about what a diffeo is, it's just like a coordinate transformation. So our x mu goes to x mu plus some mu, some discrepancy, delta x mu. And so what I'm going to do, when we look at generators of a group, what we do is we take an infinitesimal group transformation. So the idea there is we take just a very small coordinate transformation. And so that means that we write delta x mu is some small parameter epsilon times something with a sort of vector index. So here, epsilon is our small parameter. And these psi mu are the components of a vector. So what this is really saying is that vectors generate coordinate transformations. Or strictly, vector fields. So an example that I kind of want to use later just because it's quite good to have a visualization. So suppose I am in R squared and I think of a small rotation. That's a transformation on R squared. Then my I can sort of think about this as just sort of being, you know, how is this point being moved here? Well, it's kind of being moved along some constant radius. So here is the action of my transformation. So here, if I look in this quadrant, at least, obviously we know this is the action of my small rotation. So here, my psi mu is minus yx, and that is d by d theta as a vector. So that's sort of giving the idea of how vectors generate coordinate transformations. And then we see that if we look at this vector d by d theta and kind of consider curves which are at constant r, the tangent to those curves is d by d theta. So this is introducing a couple of concepts. It's this generation of the coordinate transformation, as well as the idea that if we take a vector field, we can integrate it up. So we have curves to which the vector field is tangent, and those are called integral curves. this gives us a way of at least locally looking at diffeomorphisms. Our diffeomorphism, our transformation, simply says, it's not dried, take your points on the manifold, your events. This is your the integral curves of psi, and you simply move a little distance along epsilon, along these integral curves. So that's a sort of, that's a very concrete way of imagining a diffeomorphism. You're just kind of sort of shifting things locally a little bit. So now we can ask, what are the push forward and pull back corresponding to these maps? I'm just going to move these boards because they're not very dry. So if you remember, I was drawing pictures like this before, where we had M and N, but of course now it's M and M. And then we were mapping our diffeomorphism mapped a P to a Q. And so in this case, our P, which is X mu, maps to Q, which is X mu plus epsilon psi. So that's our coordinate map, our diffeomorphism. So now what happens, what's happening with the push forward? So if I do this transformation, then at the same point, same x mu, my new components of V are always just the matrix of derivatives of the coordinate transformation. But this is my new set of coordinates. So this is just delta mu prime mu plus epsilon psi mu prime mu, comma mu. So that's my coordinate transformation. That's what the action of the push forward map is. So if I now take that and think, well, let me just use that notion of taking the vector v at the point, so if I look at that expression right on the first board, my quantity is the vector v, and I'm going to take my value of v at t plus delta t, so that is along an integral curve of psi. So I'm going to take the derivative of v along an integral curve of psi. So I can do this now because I have a means of pushing forward my v. So I can take my value of v, a little delta t along the curve, and compare it to the pushed forward value of v. So I have here my dv dt, which I'm going to have to come back to for deciding what that is notationally. So this is the idea. I take my value of V at t plus delta t, so that's what the x prime means, and I subtract off the pushed forward value of V from the original value of t. So here, V of x primed is therefore going to be V of x naught plus epsilon times the derivative of V at x naught. So that's the first term. So that's my V at x prime, x of t plus delta t. Then I have to subtract off the pushed forward value of V, which is that one there. So that is just V mu at x naught plus epsilon psi mu comma nu V nu. And then I divide by delta t, which is epsilon here. So you see that the V naughts cancel, and then the epsilons cancel. And then what I'm left with is psi nu d nu V minus V nu d nu psi. And so in other words, what I get are the components of that Lie bracket. So here, I've got exactly the same expression, but I've got it from a rather different perspective. I've got it via a mechanism which didn't rely on V being a vector. So I can obviously generalize this. Two arbitrary tensors. So for example, and we denote this which is called the Lie derivative. By a little sort of curly L. So for example, a Lie derivative of a one form has components the same sort of pattern. You always start off by the partial derivative along the vector field that you're taking the derivative with respect to, and then for every other index you either have, if it's a vector index, it's a minus sign and you take the derivative of your Lie field psi with respect to that vector index. And for every covector index, it's a plus sign, and you mop up, you kind of take the index as now a free partial derivative, but you kind of mopped up the remaining vector index. So if you're looking at the metric, for example, you start off by taking, sorry, I better do sigma. You start off by taking the partial derivative along the Lie field of the metric, and then for each of the two indices, you take the derivative of the Lie field. So that's how you build up this Lie derivative. So I'm telling you what the components sort of that Lie derivative are, but this was all built up by thinking about something geometric, diffeomorphisms. And in this case, we're getting around the need for a connection. You can take a Lie derivative on a manifold without a metric even, certainly without a connection, simply by regarding the vector field, the Lie field, as defining maps, defining diffeomorphisms, shifting the coordinates locally. And once you have that interpretation of the integral curves of your vector field, giving you a mechanism for moving around on the manifold, you've got your push forward and pull back. That means you can now shift your quantities from one point to the next and then compare them to take the derivative. So what does it look like geometrically, our Lie bracket? So there are two main things I want to highlight about the Lie derivative. So it tends to be quite intrinsically associated with symmetries or linked to symmetries and coordinate systems. And so the first thing I want to think about is more the link with coordinate systems. So to some extent, I think we kind of forget when we're looking at spacetimes that are of interest in gravity, we sort of almost jump immediately to saying, oh, well, you know, it's spherically symmetric, therefore looks like this. But it's sort of the Lie derivative is the reason why we're able to make simplifications when we think about physical spacetimes. So I first want to consider the commutator. I want to think of a process where I have two vector fields, U and V, and I first go a little distance s along v, and then a little distance t along u, and compare it with what happens when I go through a distance t along u, and then a distance s along b. So I have an origin, O, and then I have four other points, a, b, c, and d. So it's not necessarily the case that you B and D are going to be the same. And what we're going to show is that the discrepancy is related to the commutator. Right, so what I want to do is to compare B and D. Now, I'm assuming S and T are very small so that I can just do this in a local chart, and therefore this is really happening in R to the N. So what I'm going to need are two expressions which we'll use either directly or their analog. And so the first thing I'm going to do is write out the expression for the coordinates at A. So that is kind of using that middle of the top board there, thinking about what's the action of a diffeomorphism. In this case, the diffeomorphism is translations along V. But now I want to do this I'm going to Taylor expand to second order. Because I'm going to need an expression to second order to find out what that the difference between B and D is. And then I need to know how to move my vector field along those integral curves, but we've just seen how to do that. And so I'm simply going to be using these expressions or their analogs. So that tells me how I get from 0 to A. And then I want to get from A to B.
Sorry?
Yes?
Why the first line is true? What do you mean by second order?
So when you generate a group element from an element of the algebra, it's a process of exponentiating.
Yes.
So you kind of, it's like a Taylor expansion, and you're summing an infinite Taylor series. And so the first term is always straightforward because it's linear, but then there's usually a half s squared times the derivative. You know, this is really a Taylor expansion of the coordinates around the origin. So to leading order to get to A, I just step a small distance along V. But that's not precisely where A is, because I then have to consider all the other terms in that exponential. So you could think of this as sort of...
But they are not commute.
Sorry?
Not sure they are... Is it commute? Because, I mean, the generators are not commute, so...
Well, in this case, we're just kind of exponentiating SV, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you think about the first term is just SV, yeah? And then the second term is a half S squared V acting on V.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about V acting on V, if you think about it in the context of V as being the operator, so you put in a function element of C infinity of M, you've got V acting on VF, and then VF is V mu dF by dx mu, so you get the second derivative of F, but then you've also got these first derivatives of V. So if you think about this sort of exponential of SV, that's sort of how you'll see that term coming up. So that's where it's it's coming from.
Mm-hmm. Where did we solve the fact that our Q, when we were trying to define our derivative, that they're on different tangent spaces?
So where did we solve that? We solved it because, actually in this board here. So this, it looks like we haven't, I agree. It all looks a tad trivial in a way. But what we've strictly done here is we've taken the components of V in the X mu basis, and we're comparing them to the components of V in the X prime basis. Now, the X prime basis is the coordinate transform basis, or the, you know, where we've acted upon it by this diffeomorphism. So it looks, it does look a bit, I agree, it looks like we haven't done anything. I know where you're coming from. But if you like, here, this P is X mu, and this Q is X prime, right? So that's a new coordinate system, and it's a different point. So it's we're taking our V, but we're, you know, both of those Vs are actually evaluated. Arguments are the same point, but we are coordinate transforming it. So that is, you know, when you do this very abstract notation of writing, you know, V star or the push forward or pull back, because that doesn't get its hands dirty, that notation, you don't see necessarily what it's doing. So here we're getting our hands dirty. We are writing down explicitly what that map is between the two manifolds. And once you have the map between the two manifolds in a local chart, you always have an action of the map on the coordinates. And as soon as you've got that, you've got a coordinate transformation, and therefore you know how the components of a vector change. So It doesn't look like we've done it, but we have, actually. You know, in, I know it doesn't look like it, but it is. Okay, next step. I need to find B. So I'm going to use this expression, but substitute in, instead of from xA to x0, I'm going to do from xB to xA. So all I do is, to get from A to B, I've got to go along U, a distance T. So I simply replace V with U and S with T. But then I need to transform this, to translate this back into expressions at O. So XA mu is X naught plus SV at naught plus a half S squared dV, derivative of V at naught. I then substitute in here for UA. And then by the time I get to the quadratic term, I don't need to do anything because that's already order T or S squared. So that's my expression for B. And I don't really need to do any further work or thinking because the expression for D is going to be the same, but with U and V swapped and S and T swapped. So I just do that, that swap, and this is what I get. So now if I say, well, okay, so what is the discrepancy between D and B? Because I'm in a local chart, I can just quite casually take the difference, xd mu minus xb mu, because I don't have to worry. Sorry, a minute. Excuse me. Because I'm in a local chart, I'm in R to the n, so now I know a displacement vector from b to d is just xd minus xb. So you see that all of these terms, the x naughts are in common. Here's the SV and the TU, the half S squared V dV and T squared U dU. And so all I end up with is ST U nu D nu V minus V nu D nu U. In other words, the Lie bracket. So what the Lie bracket is telling me, and this should be really no surprise, geometrically it's saying how much, if I take the integral curves of each vector field, by how much do they not close if I go round or try to go round a square? And I say it shouldn't be a surprise because, of course, when we first met this Lie derivative, the commutator, we actually said, you know, we met this by saying uv minus vu acting on functions. And so that sort of embodies in it this idea of going first along u and then v, and then subtracting, going along v, then u. So it kind of all fits with that definition. So the other way of thinking about this is, if a Lie bracket doesn't vanish, then you can't use S and T as coordinates. Because the one thing that you have to have about coordinates is a unique labeling of every point. But it doesn't follow that if Lie brackets don't vanish, that there aren't sensible coordinates associated with them. So we'll kind of see that in a little bit. So what, that's sort of thinking about the Lie bracket and its geometry. What about symmetries? Well, if something has a vanishing Lie derivative, that means that if you drag it along that integral curve, pushing it forward, the whole pullback, whichever's relevant, the whole time, it doesn't change. That's what the Lie derivative means, being zero means. So this is telling us something about an invariance of that quantity Q. So when Q is the metric, that's particularly important because it's saying that as we drag or push forward, pull back, sorry, the metric along these curves, then it's not changing. So this is actually quite an important concept, this idea of having symmetries of the metric. And so I want to kind of spend a little bit of time on it. And we have a special name for these Lie, these vectors, these psis. They're called Killing vectors. So just to be explicit, that's what the equation for a Killing vector is. So it's saying that the metric is invariant as you move along these integral curves. So Killing vectors are important because they tell you about symmetries of the metric, and ultimately, when when you have a continuous symmetry, you also have conserved quantities. So it's also going to tell you about conserved quantities. So they're really quite important when we work with gravity. So it's probably easiest to just see by example. And so I'm going to pick an example that's particularly useful for physical applications. So I'm going to consider a triplet of three vectors. I've got to get them right, get the signs right. So here is a triplet of three vectors that I'm representing as, in some coordinate patch, as combinations of derivatives d by d theta and d by d phi. Now, these three vectors obey the commutation relations. But if you take the commutator of any two, you get the third up to a sign. So this is an SO3 algebra. So it's specifically SO3 because there's just a theta and phi there. So what happens if we have a metric that has these three vectors as killing vectors? So if we have these three killing vectors that obey this algebra, then we say our metric has spherical symmetry. So that's obviously very useful physically because many systems do have spherical symmetry. So that's usually how we start to analyze stars or black holes. So let's just look at what that tells us about our metric. So the first thing is, if L3 of G is zero, that's just where our third killing vector has a single component, d by d phi, with just a unit. So the components of the killing vector psi 3 are 0, 1 in the theta phi direction. So that tells me there's no phi dependence in the metric. So that's already helped. That means that whatever my, you know, in general, our metric has 10 independent components. So now we know none of them depend on phi. So now let me look at what happens for the first two components. So for psi 1. So what I've done here is I've taken the first killing vector And it has a theta component of sine phi. So that means that from the first part of the Killing equation here, psi, the partial derivatives of g contracted with psi, I'm going to have a sine phi d by d theta of g. So that's the first term. And then I'm going to have cot theta cos phi times d by d phi of g, which I'm, but we know that's zero. I was thinking it's not there, but of course we know it's zero. Then the remaining pieces here are the second and third terms on the of the Killing equation. So for example, if I look here, if I look at the phi, the theta component of psi 1 is sine phi. So if I take the derivative of that with respect to phi, the only thing that it depends on is phi. So here I get a cos phi. And so that tells me that this is only when mu is phi do I get this non-zero term. So that's where this piece is coming from. And it's only for the theta component there. And similarly, this piece here is the theta derivative of the phi component of psi 1, and this is the phi derivative of the phi component of psi 1. So here, that's why you see this being phi and mu having to be a phi. So you can check it yourself offline. So that's psi 1. What if we take psi 2? Then we get cos, wherever we see a sine, and we get a minus sine wherever we see a cos. So because this has got to be true for all phi, sine and cos are independent functions. So that means that this term and this term have to be zero when you put them together, and this term have to be zero when you put them together. So from this, I can read off so this is simply taking this as the sine piece, and this one is the cos piece of psi 1. So now if I look at those, obviously here, if mu and nu are not, neither of them is phi, that tells me there's no theta dependence at all in those components, yeah?
Can you repeat what you did there?
To get from here to there?
Yeah.
Okay, so what I did was I simply paired off, let's get some colored chalk. So this is a sine phi, right? Sine phi and cos phi. I can't, you know, because this has to be true for all values of phi, that means that the term multiplying sine, this, and this, that has to be zero separately to the term multiplying cos. Otherwise, it's not going to be true for all phi. So that's all I've done is I've grouped together the terms multiplying sine and the terms multiplying cos. Right. So now if I go here and I start thinking about what, you know, what does that second equation tell me? Suppose, just for example, I take mu equals phi and nu equals t, just for example, then that's zero, and the only thing that's not zero is this one. So that tells me that g theta t equals zero. So by simply picking various choices of the indices, I find that g t phi, g r theta, g r phi are all zero. So I now know that I have no cross terms between what's going on in the rest of my metric and what's going on in the theta phi part of my metric. So then, if I look at what's left, if I take mu and nu equal to theta, everything drops out in the second equation, and in the first equation, I get g theta theta comma theta is zero. So I'm kind of running out of options now. I've only got mu and nu being theta phi. So now if mu and nu are phi, so if I take now the phi phi component of each of those equations, I see that g theta phi also vanishes, and I know something about how g phi phi looks. So g phi phi is proportional to sine squared theta. Finally, mu is theta, nu is phi, tells me g theta theta is g phi phi times cosec squared theta. So that tells me, go back to the other side, that's kind of boiled down all of those general terms in the metric down to considerably fewer. So if I put all this information together, this is what my metric has to look like if it has SO3 invariants. So in general, again, we have 10 components of the metric, and now what we've reduced these down to are 4 separate functions. So that's saying that this is just some multiplying factor, and this is the metric on a unit 2-sphere. And so that unit 2-sphere, it's saying that our metric has these surfaces of revolution on which it doesn't change. So I can take my space-time and kind of turn it this way and that, and it looks exactly the same. So that's what our, it's a bit of a grungy calculation, but that's what our Lie derivative has told us. And this has not used anything other than about the metric, other than there is one, and it has an SO3 invariance. I've not assumed anything about a connection or any further structure. So any metric with SO3 invariance will look like this, independent of what the connection is on your space-time. So our using symmetries and Lie and not Lie, Killing vectors is very useful in terms of making a job easier as a relativist. So I'm just going to be using this tomorrow, so I want to write it down. It's quite easy to prove. So if we think about, this is now sort of taking commutators of the vectors acting on the sort of covectors, but this tells us a relation between D and the Lie bracket. Probably a good point to stop. So I'll finish there.